This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. After Eugene Chadbourne saw the Beatles on television as a boy, he picked up a guitar and he started noodling. It was the beginning of a career in improvisational music techniques that has taken him to underground venues around the world. And his collaborations with other traveling musicians brought him here to Greensboro, where his combination of musical genres like country, roots, and jazz have embraced him, or found him embraced, with a cult following. And he joins me now on The State of Things. Eugene Chadbourne, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
You got your banjo with you, and you play guitar and all kinds of different stuff. Tell us about that moment, that seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, I assume, right?
Well, if I really tell you the truth about it, it takes away a lot from music. I really didn't think they looked good. I didn't like the music. I didn't see anything interesting about it. Until I got to school the next day, all the girls were talking about it. Up till then, there was no way to get a girlfriend without being good at sports or beating someone up. This was a whole new thing. You could get good at music and girls would like you.
You know, I had the same experience, though. I will tell you, I saw that show, and the same thing happened to me. I admired Ed Sullivan so much, I decided from that day forward I wanted to host my own show.
Really?
Yeah. So this is cool. So obviously this was you thought a chick magnet for you. Did it work? What happened?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You started playing the guitar, but you really were not... Of course, rock and roll was kind of just in its infancy. It wasn't as big a thing by 1963 as it was. What music did you gravitate to immediately?
I was just trying to learn how to play anything on the guitar. You know, we used to play along with the radio, just strumming the open strings.
Yeah.
But this was better than the guys would do this with just tennis rackets. That's the first official rock bands in our school were these guys with tennis rackets that would put a Beatles record on and pretend to play.
Did you get a bunch of guys together and just stand around a record player with brooms? Because we did that, actually. Yeah.
We had a guy sent away for a bass from Sears Roebuck.
Wow.
He didn't have any idea how to tune it or how to play it or anything, but we started a band. But we only played in his garage.
Yeah, well, hence the
and,
term.
This by the time we had this band, this was one of the popular records was called "Wheels of Fire" by Cream. You know, one whole side was one song. So,
when did you start getting serious about music?
I was always really serious about it. I always really liked it, but I think it was really when. Musicians I really liked told me I should become a professional that I stopped thinking about doing anything else. It was particularly for one guy, Anthony Braxton. I organized a concert for him when I lived in Western Canada, and he came up there and he said, I've been listening to tapes of you playing music, and you should be a professional musician. And, of course, all my friends in the city hated me and were all talking about how I couldn't really play. Mm-hmm. But when I heard it from that guy, I thought, well, I don't need to hear it from anybody else. And that got me going.
There's only one valid source here, and that's Braxton. So your style now, you're really kind of famous for your improvisational techniques. Who were your, after the Beatles, who did you start to really admire and really want to play with?
Well, play with, that's something else. But, I mean, Jimi Hendrix, that was mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix and Chuck Berry. Those are the two great rock guitar players to me.
But you also played, I mean, you talk about the influence of Frank Zappa to some extent, and you actually played with one of the members of one of his many bands, right?
Jimmy Carl Black, and a little bit some of the other guys, Don Preston and Bunk Gardner, but really Jimmy Carl Black and I worked together.
Tell us about Jimmy, because he's somebody whose name we might not be familiar with, but if you know anything about Frank Zappa, you might remember his character in that band.
Well, this was a funny thing in a way, because we all knew him not from a song. This was something that was really a revelation to me, the musicians in the group talking and complaining about not making any money. Up till that point, I thought all rock stars were rich and famous and had sports cars and big houses. And here was this guy. First of all, I was excited because he was an American Indian and rock musician. That was like my two favorite things combined. And there he was talking about, when are we going to make some money? I was just fascinated by this. But everybody knew him from this coming on this record and saying, hi, boys and girls, I'm Jimmy Carl Black, and I'm the Indian of the group. And we used to just repeat that endlessly. Yeah. And many people did, too. He was famous for this one particular thing.
It turns out Zappa was kind of a jerk when it came to his bands, right? I mean, he didn't pay people, and he was ripping them off left and right. Not a nice guy. Not a nice guy by anybody's
that's
account.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Yeah.
That's what they write about him.
Jimmy made a lot of money playing with me. I was always really happy about that.
You have reworked the music of a lot of different artists, including Ozzy Osbourne. What about that? What do you do when you? I mean, yeah, trying to work this into your own. How do you do that?
There's actually somebody on some guitar site on internet complaining that I'm playing the Ozzy Osbourne thing in a minor key rather than major. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't know. I learned that once because I had a guitar student that wanted to learn it. So
you want to? You've got your banjo with you now.
Yeah.
Can you play something for us?
This is a song I wrote called "The Old Piano."
Gene Chadbourne. You are also famous for using many genres and mixing and matching, and that has a definite roots feel. Do you feel influenced when you write a song? Do you feel like, oh, this is a root song, this is an old-timey song? Or do all of those influences kind of flow into your music when you're writing?
Well, that particular song, the motivation was really about the lyrics. It started with this piano that just sat and got ruined and nobody was playing it, nobody ever had time, and then that kind of inspired the other things, and I don't really remember how I put the music together. Sometimes I have kind of elaborate procedures to create the music, to find the chords. I have all kinds of different things I do. I don't remember what I did, but a lot of people that have played that They think it's an old-time music tune. They think it's a traditional tune. But it's definitely structured like one.
Do you pay attention? Once you get going, do you realize, okay, this has got to remain in kind of that old-timey structure or not? I mean, does that to some extent dictate to you once you get a few chords down, you say, well, this is where that's got to go?
Yeah, well, in that case, that's I don't think that. And for instance, there's a song that doesn't have a bridge. It doesn't have a second part,
So you talked about being in Canada, and that's when you were inspired to really kind of take this seriously and become a professional. You came back from Canada in the 1970s. What happened then? Because you've done a lot of traveling. Did you tour the U.S., or what happened to your career at that moment?
Well, before I left Calgary, Alberta, I had created two vinyl albums, which I pressed on my own, 500 copies of the first, 1,000 of the second. And I started sending them out. I sent them out to musicians I knew, to radio station, college radio particularly. And after a few months of that, I had a lot of contacts around the country, people that were interested in the record and said, oh, I could get you a concert at the college, or you could play here. And this was all new to me. I really didn't know that much about doing this kind of thing. But I was able to go back to the States. They'd had an amnesty, and so...
We forgot to point out that you were a draft dodger.
I was a draft dodger, yeah. So Jimmy Carter said I could come back, so I was hot to come back.
He was not reelected. I just point that out. I don't know if there's a connection there.
Some people think it had to do with the Iran thing, but it might have to do with this.
I forget,
But who knows? Anyway, so I spent that first... I spent a long period, 2 or 3 months, just traveling from place to place, sometimes a day, a night or two. Sometimes I was there. I did a recording of the third record I made with two other guitar players I'd met. We did that in New England. Finally, I think 2 or 3 days before I was sort of aimed toward New York City. That was like, for instance... Mr. Braxton said, if you're going to play jazz, you have to go to... So he gave me two pieces of advice. He said, learn to read music and go to New York.
So, you did.
So I was headed to New York, and about a week before I got to New York, I called my oldest brother, who was living in New York, and he said, well, your timing is good. One of our roommates has just moved out. So I had me a little apartment there for $200 a month.
Whoa,
In New York. So I was able to go in there and live off my savings for a while. And
Then,
I don't know if you can still do that. One of the first guys I started playing with, he says, are you getting food stamps? I said, why would I get? He says, because you don't earn enough money as a musician. And in New York, that's considered a job.
Whoa.
That was true. So while I was floundering around there, we were making, $5 a night or something like that. I had all these things. So I was able to survive. And
what brought you to Greensboro?
Well, I met, I started teaching. One of the things I was doing, I was teaching at a school that no longer exists outside of Woodstock, New York, called the Creative Music Studio. It was run by a bunch of musicians. And I used to go up there, teach guitar, et cetera, workshop, orchestra classes, just anything. And I met a drummer, very nice guy, usual kind of thing. If you ever are coming to Greensboro, North Carolina, I can organize a concert for you. So I stayed in touch with this fellow. His name was David Licht. And he was also very known in this, well known in this community as a house painter. He's probably painted half the houses in the city. Mm-hmm. But I eventually went on tour with a Japanese musician who had a student visa in New York, Toshinori Kondo. Mm-hmm. I decided it would be amusing to take him on tour through the Deep South. So we went everywhere, and basically our philosophy was try to play the weirdest music anyone had ever heard. This was our challenge. And we had two nights organized in Greensboro. One was at, how there are these places, everywhere you go, it's a business, it closes. It's a business, it closes. It just keeps closing. This place it's on Tate Street. I don't know what it is now. It's been so many different things. At that point, it was a little club called the Bellstone Fox. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were playing, and In the first 5 minutes, the entire audience left. And then it filled with people from the street that were wanting to listen and sat
down. Wow.
So the guy from the club came out and interrupted us. And he said, "You've driven away all the audience." I said, "What about these people?" He said, "That's not my regular clientele." So he told the drummer, "You guys have to stop." So the drummer said, "We're fired." I said, "What about our $200? And he says, "I don't think the guy's going to give us the $200. So I told Kondo, who was a he was an expert in this. It's not exactly a martial art. It's a physical movement thing called Shintaido.
I see.
But is this joker going to know the difference?
No, no.
All he saw was, I said, "Kondo, do some of your exercises for a minute here." So he stood out in front of there doing this stuff, and the guy coughed up the $200. then we went across the street to the Nightshade Cafe, to the Hong Kong House.
Oh.
To talk to our employer for the next night, because it was Amelia Luang, and she had stood out on the street listening to this. So we went downstairs. David said, "We better make sure we can still play here tomorrow night, you know." Yeah. So we go down there, and she's washing the dishes in the kitchen. And so we walk in there, and she says, I'll never forget this. She says, I can't tell you that I understand what you're doing or why you're doing it. But if you have the courage to do it, then you can do it in my opinion.
You have about a minute to do it here as we close our show. But Eugene Chadbourne, what a delight. Thank you so much for being on our program. He's a musician. You can find him anywhere in the streets of Greensboro. Just listen through the walls and you'll find him. And more information at our website, stateofthings.org. From North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow. Once again, Eugene Chadbourne. Thank you.